We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Today is June 6th, 2024. And so this is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. And as we are broadcasting live this morning, President Joe Biden has just stepped up to the microphone to deliver an address from near the shores of Normandy. And as The Hill reports, it was on that region's beaches, along its cliffs and in its fields, that the Allied troops began the liberation of France from Nazi occupation on June 6, 1944. Against that historic backdrop, Biden's visit is also part of his effort to reaffirm U.S. leadership in NATO and its commitment to the defense of Ukraine. So a very different focus for Joe Biden this morning, and a lot more politicized for the present day than it was 40 years ago in an address that President Reagan spoke that day on the 40th anniversary of D-Day in 1984. 1984, of course, was his second re-election. It would happen that November. I was born November 1st of 1984, and 5 days later, on November 6th, my mom and my parents would go and vote for Reagan for a second time. And so that year obviously has had a significant part of my life. But that was the 40th anniversary of D-Day, that June 6th of 1984. And the full speech that President Reagan gave from Normandy, you can watch that on the Reagan Library. And the whole thing is about 13 minutes. We don't have time to play the entire clip today. But we're going to play just part of the beginning. That's titled Mark That Day, where Reagan is overlooking the cliffs where American Rangers had climbed up ropes in the face of German soldiers who were firing down on them. I mean, this was an historic battle that really did mark the turning point for the Allied forces in World War II. And this is just a portion of what President Reagan spoke that day.
We're here to mark that day in history when the Allied armies joined in battle to reclaim this continent to liberty. For four long years, much of Europe had been under a terrible shadow. Free nations had fallen. Jews cried out in the camps. Millions cried out for liberation. Europe was enslaved, and the world prayed for its rescue. Here in Normandy, the rescue began. Here, the Allies stood and fought against tyranny in a giant undertaking unparalleled in human history. We stand on a lonely, windswept point on the northern shore of France. The air is soft, but 40 years ago at this moment, the air was dense with smoke and the cries of men, and the air was filled with the crack of rifle fire and the roar of cannon. At dawn on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion: to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns.
Speech. And again, go to YouTube or to the Reagan Foundation, and you can listen to the remainder of that speech. And it concludes with Reagan saying how we are bound today, and that was 40 years ago, to to all of the forces and all of the men and women who served in our military as a grateful nation. And it was a very solemn moment, and it was amazing. And I posted this morning on the 80th anniversary of D-Day, so this is 40 years later. I am a grateful American to every member, past, present, and future, of our armed forces. These men and women deserve our respect and gratitude for their dedication to the cause of liberty. And 40 years prior to when Reagan spoke, of course, that was the actual D-Day. And on that day, President Franklin Roosevelt was monitoring the progress of the battle from the White House in Washington, D.C. And God-fearing people across the nation were listening in to his radio program and his radio broadcast. I mean, this is the impact that radio broadcast has had in modern media, and radio is, as most of you know who listen, my favorite media. I think radio has the opportunity to get into a lot of subjects in depth. We can philosophize more. We can talk more deeply about theology, history, as we're doing today, politics, as we usually do. And President Roosevelt was very well known for his fireside chats. And those were a series of evening radio addresses given by Franklin Roosevelt, the 32nd president of the United States between 1933 and 1944. And so he used one of his radio broadcasts to pray. And Americans heard him speak and pray to God in a nationwide radio broadcast on June 6th of 1944. And I want to play that full prayer. This is about 6 minutes long, because imagine if we had such a president of the United States today that was willing to address the nation, not for political purposes, not to, you know, further a campaign or any sort of political effort. And obviously what we're dealing with today in a commemoration 80 years later is very different than what they were dealing with that day. But no matter what we deal with every day as a nation, we should have a commander in chief that is willing to turn to God in prayer in front of the nation. This is what President Roosevelt had to say on his radio broadcast, June 6th of 1944.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too. Strengthen our daily tasks to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travel, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
That was President Franklin Roosevelt 80 years ago, and it's just incredible that we still have that radio broadcast 80 years later. And what an amazing moment to not only commemorate the sacrifices of those who gave the last full measure of their devotion 80 years today on the beaches of Normandy, but to remember through American history how many, whether in the armed forces or in other capacities, have given their lives to the cause of liberty. And in this moment that we commemorate the 80th anniversary, we should all stop and pray for the future of our country. Remember the past, but to pray to the Lord for the future of our country and for the cause of liberty, that we would turn again and have a president that is willing to openly pray on a nationwide broadcast. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
People have value, but just where does it come from?
God created us in His image, as male and female.
But the enemy is deceiving so many.
We like to shake our fist at God and say, "Why did you make me this way? I don't like it. I'm going to define who I am for myself."
We must stand on God's truth.
Can we change God's words? Can we change the tense? It's just the tense of the verb. Come on. To be able to get along with everybody, we don't have the luxury to edit what God has said.
In His Image is a life-changing film that takes you through Scripture and shares powerful testimonies to destroy Satan's attempts to pervert God's perfect design.
There's only one last major holdout in society to shed light on what the truth is, and that is the church.
Watch it again or for the first time. Get the 2-DVD set at resources.afa.net. Resources.afa.net.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And in the last segment, we were talking about the commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day, a historic turning point in World War II. And, you know, if you asked the average college student today who is going to a lot of these leftist institutions, and I'm not talking about homeschool graduates and, you know, other students who actually have learned about history, but the average, you know, kid on the street that, you know, you'd interview in Times Square, as some of these do, like my good friend Will Witt, who is well known for some of his kind of man on the street interviews. Could any of these students actually articulate what World War II was even all about, when it was, or anything about American history? And the answer to that, unfortunately, generally, is no. And according to a new op-ed in The Hill, today, many believe that the primary function of higher education and institutions is to provide a platform for activism. But as this op-ed goes on to say, and the headline is, activism is not the mission of university. So joining me now is Nicholas Giordano, who is a campus reform higher education fellow and the author of this piece. And he joins me now. So, you know, higher education has been in the news lately, especially in universities, Professor Giordano, with all of these campus protests. And it seems like so many of these students think that their role and function as a student to build the best resume is to be an activist rather than genuinely a student of their discipline.
That's certainly true, Jenna, and thanks for having me. And you started off talking about this day and D-Day and how students don't know much, right? I mean, they go, they're a generation that has the most schooling out of any previous generation, and yet it seems they know less than a previous generation. And when it comes to World War II, only 43% of students are aware of the specific time frame in which the Holocaust took place, in which World War II took place. Only 38% know how many Jews were killed in the Holocaust, and only 33% know that Hitler was elected, democratically elected, as the Chancellor of Germany through the democratic process over there. So it's a sad state of affairs. And the point of the Hill article was to show that a lot of these politicians, professors, and the college administrators, they seem to have forgotten what education, what the real purpose of higher education is, and they've forgotten that it's about scholarship, it's about research, it's getting students to think critically and creating the next generation of productive citizens that are willing to put the community in America above themselves, to make America a better place. And what scares me as a college professor is seeing how little the American students know about the country that they've been living in for their entire lives, or at least most of their lives. And how can we compare this generation to the World War II generation? where in this generation they've been taught to almost despise America, that America is seen as a racist and an oppressive place. So I think we have some real challenges within the education front, and I think it's been exposed over the course of the last few months with the students calling for intifada, chanting death to Jews, death to America, and supporting pro-Hamas organizations. It really is astounding what we're witnessing.
It really is, and it's very unfortunate, especially when we go back and look at the history of some of these great universities and institutions that, you know, a lot of them began as seminaries. I mean, they were places to literally study theology and the knowledge of God, and then through the knowledge of God and in his revealed universe, then study other things like, you know, science and math and, you know, all of these other discoveries and things that were grounded in reality. And yet, so much of the funding and so much of the mission of higher education now is simply indoctrination into these false ideologies that have nothing to do with reality. I mean, what would you say, Professor Giordano, it was really the turning point in American higher education and why?
Well, over the course of the last 40 or 50 years, it's no secret that a higher education always skewed to the left. But really, over the last 20 years, we've seen a profound change. Now, some of this shift has to do with the idea of de-emphasizing subjects like American history, like literature and the arts for the STEM fields. So some of it comes from that. However, the bigger problem, and I wrote about this for Campus Reform, is that the professors of today and even the teachers in the K-12 system are much more ideological than previous educators. What I mean by that is I had Marxist professors growing up. It's not like it was a secret, but they respected education, and they were subject matter experts in their field. They understood the field. Today's generation that's going in, they don't have the same knowledge when it comes to the subject material they're teaching, and so the deficiency that they have, they're replacing with their political ideology, and that's how it's become about activism and pushing a leftist agenda over actual education and empowerment that's creating the next generation of employees and Americans that are going to go out there and make us a stronger country. We just saw, a few weeks ago over at Google, that you had Palestinian employees protesting, pro-Palestinian employees protesting, and the company laid them off, said that's enough. We can't deal with this childish behavior anymore. But what I think is an interesting dynamic is we're seeing this at the four-year Ivy League institutions where there's this groupthink mentality. I teach at a community college, and when you look at community colleges around the country, we're not seeing the same type of students. And I think that's interesting and important to point out because the student body is different. They're more in tune with the real world. We don't see the same level of activism. Sure, there's certain types of protests, but for the most part, the students at community colleges are there for a reason. They're either working full time, they may be taking care of families and have children. They may be taking care of elderly parents or adults returning to school. So they don't engage in this self-entitled activism where they believe their righteousness outweighs the mission of any type of college. Instead, they're able to engage in debate critically, and they want to learn. They want to better their lives. So they understand that. So I think what we're seeing is a great dichotomy between the four-year elite institutions versus the community colleges that have largely been marginalized throughout the decades.
That's a really fascinating observation that, you know, people who are really focused on bettering themselves, furthering their career, they have families that they have to take care of. I mean, things that are practical actually want to learn as opposed to these elite institutions where a lot of these students are probably going there because their parents are paying for it, and you know they don't really have a whole lot of job responsibilities. And of course, it's a generalization. That's not everyone at these elite institutions, but is there a type of student that goes to the elite institutions that because of their upbringing and their family and social life, they tend to already be more liberal and go to universities for the purpose of political activism, or does it mainly start when they go to those elite universities?
Well, I think it starts before then, in recent times. Prior to that, it was just the background they're coming from. I mean, let's face it, at most of these institutions, the four-year Ivy League institutions, you're dealing with the same type of people that have the same similar backgrounds. They come from the upper middle class families, the well-to-do within society, that may be politically active, and then they go to the college campuses, and yes, they don't have to work or take care of their families, and so with all the time on their hands, they engage in activism. But I also think a lot of it has to do with what's happened over the course of the last decade, where students have been indoctrinated to believe that they should be ashamed of themselves, right? Because of the color of their skin, because their families may have succeeded and made money, and that they should be ashamed of themselves. And so they have to capitulate to all these leftist causes in order to feel better about themselves, to pat themselves on the back. And of course, I'm talking about the whole white privilege and those that believe that racism is inherent at birth, depending on the skin color, the victim versus victimizer mentality. I think that also has a lot to do with it. And then you factor in the entitlement generation, where everyone got a trophy, where self-esteem was promoted as the most important thing, that we have to treat children as these fragile beings that can't handle any real criticism, that can't be told that they're not going to get their way all the time. And I think we're now seeing this play out in the real world of how it's working. Because it's not working. It's been an abysmal failure because we see the entitlement culture that exists. We're seeing in the workplace, we've written about it at Campus Reform, that the new generation is the hardest, most difficult generation to work with. 90% of them have ghosted interviews. They show up late to work. Managers have reported having difficulty in getting them to do their actual jobs. So we really see the profound effect that the education system has on a society, and that's why we need to fix it.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And your op-ed is so right, Professor Giordano. I'm speaking with Nicholas Giordano, who's a political science professor at a community college, and he mentioned, and also a Leadership Institute Campus Reform Higher Education Fellow. And you say that these institutions must refocus on their core mission, critical thinking, scholarship, and merit. If they do this, they may be able to reclaim their integrity and rebuild trust. If not, they will continue their decline into irrelevancy. How can, in just the last minute I have with you, how can universities do that? And could Congress, through defunding some of these things and trying to get them to refocus?
Well, Congress can certainly help. But I think more importantly, it comes down to parents and the large donors. I mean, American confidence in higher education is at historic lows. Just 36% of American parents and students have confidence in the higher education system. The employers are doing away with four-year degree programs. So I think that these universities need to recalibrate and go back to the roots, go back to the idea of actual education, introduce standards, reintroduce merit into the system. And I think that they have a potential to again, regain that trust. So hopefully they do that. If not, they go off into the field of irrelevancy.
Yes, and hopefully then our students who actually want to learn will be wiser in their choice as well of higher education institutions. So Nicholas Giordano, always appreciate it. You can read his op-ed in The Hill. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we saw this morning, President Joe Biden wrapping up his fairly brief and very political remarks from Normandy commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We also turn to some more political events, and we're joined by Representative Bob Good, who is the chairman of the Freedom Caucus and a member of several of the GOP committees and from the great state of Virginia. So, Representative Good, thanks so much for joining us again. And there's so much going on in Washington this week between Congress's response to the Hunter Biden trial, to the Fauci interrogation and hopefully calls for accountability, Biden's executive order for the border. So where would you like to start?
Well, thank you, Jenna, for having me again. And what a sobering day to remember one of the greatest victories in the history of not just America, but in the history of the world, when evil was defeated by the largest invasion, land invasion in the history of the world, in the war that cost more lives than any others. And what gratitude we have as a country that we are not speaking German, we are not speaking Japanese, because of the greatest generation who gave everything to ensure that what we have today would endure, that America and the founding principles and the freedoms and the blessings of liberty that were passed on to us do endure. So we remember, and it also should strengthen our resolve that what we're fighting for really matters. That's why what you're doing matters so much. And as Ronald Reagan told us decades ago, freedom is not free, and it does not automatically pass down to the next generation, but it must be fought for. And thank God for those who did that during World War II, who did that on D-Day, and those who have done that throughout our history to serve and to sacrifice, and some giving the ultimate sacrifice.
So well said. And we are a grateful nation to continue to pursue the cause of liberty. And as Reagan also said, freedom is just one generation away from utter obliteration. And obviously I'm paraphrasing that a little bit, but I mean, it seems like it's not even one generation away anymore. It seems like it's almost, it could just be barely one election away, and it could even be just one executive order away.
Yes. And if I may, Jenna, because you said to me, hey, where would I like to start to pivot to the politics of the day or the reality of the day, I think these events that you talked about, these issues that you talked about, whether it's Fauci, whether it's Merrick Garland, whether it's the persecution of President Trump through the abuse of power by the Department of Injustice, whether it's the border invasion and Biden trying to cover himself for that, all of that points to how the Republican House majority, the only thing standing between an even greater, all-out, more full assault on the American people, as the Republican House majority is the only thing that can temper that at all, the one power we do have, the greatest responsibility we have in the House, is the funding of the government, is the power of the purse. So really the only thing meaningful we're really going to do in divided government over the remaining months of this Congress is fund the government as of October 1. So our charge, our task of responsibility is by September 30 to somehow fund this government, or it would shut down, and you and some others and I might argue shutting it down would be better than obviously doing more harm, and that's something, as you know, that I fought for my nearly 4 years in Congress, to be willing to do that if necessary to fight for change on policy as well as spending level. But the Republican House majority has the opportunity not to fund the border invasion, not to depart to fund the weaponization of the Department of Injustice, the abuse of FBI, not to fund these agencies that were complicit in the harm that was perpetrated by Fauci and his allies and his associates that we will never recover from, our school children will never recover from, those who died unnecessarily will obviously never return to us, and the trampling on basic freedoms and the policies we campaign against and all these things. We have the ability to fight against that instead of doing what has happened for the past year and a half under the previous speaker and the current speaker, which is let's preemptively avoid any disruption, show we can get along, show we can work together, show we can compromise, meaning do what the Democrats want, do what Chuck Schumer will pass, do what Biden will sign, so that we can just get along together and go along and keep government running and hurting the American people. So that's what it's all about between now and the end of September. And frankly, that's all that's going to be meaningful in this Congress between now and the end of the year when the new Congress is sworn in on January 3rd.
And I'm speaking with Congressman Bob Good, and I think that's very aptly put, and especially with a very slim majority, there is only so much that you can do, and the main purpose would be to thwart any sort of budgeting or legislation or anything that would be detrimental to the country. And we talk a lot on the show about just the political will to actually do that good. And is there political will within the Republican very slim majority to take that up to the point of a potential government shutdown? Because it seems like the Democrats are willing to hold out and to say, well, it's the Republicans that are going to shut this down, and they somehow twist the narrative and they have all of the talking points, and ultimately then members on the Republican side cave and they say, okay, fine, we'll give you whatever you want just to avoid maybe some bad press, rather than telling the Democrats, no, you have to actually give us some things as well.
You're framing it exactly right, Jenna. So is that resolve there? It has not been demonstrated over the past year and a half, as you know. However, it could be. But the only way it's going to be, there's two ways where it's going to change. One, obviously, at the ballot box, if Republicans across the country elect constitutional conservatives, courageous conservative warriors, instead of moderate establishment rhinos who've been sticking it to them, if between now and then, and we're back in our districts today, we're traveling our districts today, and as members are back in their districts, if the people rise up and say, no more, we will not tolerate this, we will not accept this, and you must vote for change, you must show results. So if the people rise up and make their voices heard, and these members are afraid of going along in status quo and doing what they've been doing for the past year and a half, then perhaps now. Otherwise, we've got to change who's nominated. That's why these races are so important across the country, who we nominate, who we endorse, who we allow to wear the brand, because history would not indicate that resolve was there except for somewhere in the range of maybe a third, speaking generously, of Republicans. About two-thirds haven't shown that courage to do it. They're afraid of a government shutdown more than they are afraid of voting to keep the policies and the spending levels in place that are bankrupting and destroying the country.
Yeah, and it's just it's so frustrating as a conservative watching the lack of resolve of political will. And this is why elections do matter, and why primaries matter, and why putting up the best people who will go to Washington and actually stand for that resolve. And we're all very thankful that you do, Congressman Bob Good, and as the chair of the Freedom Caucus, and you will stand for the Constitution, for the policies that are good, regardless of the headlines, because at the end of the day, it should matter more what is actually done than what the media spins and reports about it. Because, I mean, you know, you're never going to get good coverage by the people who hate you. So what does it matter anyway? But there are a lot of people who care more about the media than they do about actually standing for the right propositions. And so heading into November, just from a political standpoint, I mean, there are so many races that are so important. It's not just the presidential race. So much focus is on Trump versus Biden, but this is all the way down ticket as well. What is your thought, and what should our audience, you know, that's national, that, you know, is voting in a lot of different elections, the statewide that will determine the makeup of Congress, what should people be looking for, and how would you tell them to vote their values for November so that we can get a good makeup of Congress for the next session?
You're exactly right, Jenna. Thank you for asking that. And I'll on a personal level just say my race is the highest profile primary race in the country. The swamp is striking back, trying to punish the Freedom Caucus for standing for change, for challenging Washington, for fighting the status quo, for saying, hey, going along to get along is not going to save the country. We can't keep doing what we've always done. This is unsustainable. The border invasion, the spending levels, the reauthorization of FISA without a warrant requirement. So my race, quite frankly, is it Freedom Caucus or is it going to be McCarthy's revenge tour? Is it true courageous conservatives fighting for change or is it going to be the deep swamp that's buying this race? So if they'll go to bobgoodforcongress.com, they can support my race, a fight for freedom, a fight for the Freedom Caucus, a fight for true conservatism, and not letting the swamp buy my seat. So I am the most high-profile race in the country from a primary standpoint on the Republican side. But then across the country, don't vote in primaries for Republicans who voted for these omnibus spending bills, who voted to borrow $100 billion and send it overseas, most of it to Ukraine, with $9 billion for Hamas, and who voted to reauthorize FISA without a warrant requirement protecting your constitutional freedoms. Don't vote for those Republicans in a primary.
Yeah, very, very well said. And I think that a lot of voters, unfortunately, see this as just more Republican versus Democrat. And so whoever is running on the Republican ticket, it's one Republican versus the other, rather than understanding that, you know, there are some people who run on the Republican side that aren't necessarily a good candidates. And we want to put up the best people for the general election so that there is a stalwart conservative that is an option to vote for. And so primaries are very important. And for everyone listening, hopefully you know the dates of your primaries, you know the elections that are happening in your states. And AFA Action, you know, has a lot of information in terms of voting your values in some of those races as well. But let's turn in, you know, the last about 8 or 9 minutes that I have with you, Representative Good, and I so appreciate your time this morning, to a couple of other things going on in Washington. And, you know, you mentioned as well Dr. Fauci and the lack of accountability. I mean, it was so pathetic watching him in those congressional hearings. Just, I mean, almost just giving this bland, flippant, you know, yeah, I mean, that, you know, I kind of made that up, whatever. But not really, I think, understanding the gravity of the moment. And while defunding some of these things and ensuring that that can never happen again, I asked Representative Tiffany this same question yesterday on the program, and I want to ask you as well, is there any consideration by Republicans for legislation, either especially from Congress or that you're maybe aware of on the state level, that would not allow the weaponization of these emergency powers acts that would completely obliterate the legislative purview and allow for these executive agencies to put these health restrictions in the midst of a so-called crisis like what we saw during COVID, and to say, you know, no, this can't be weaponized?
Yes, absolutely. We have sponsored some legislation over these past couple of years that hasn't really gotten anywhere because obviously the Democrat Senate doesn't support it and the president doesn't support it. But yes, to eliminate the president's executive authority his administration to operate through the agencies, the unelected department heads and the bureaucrats of these departments and agencies to abuse their power or to expand their power to make laws, quite frankly, without Congress. And to your point, these emergency powers really need to be reined in where they've just got tremendous impact on things that they can do. And so absolutely, Paul Gosar from Arizona has been a real leader on this issue. Just as an example, he's been a real fighter on this issue about ending these emergencies. We finally got the COVID emergency ended, quite frankly, and it was, almost 2 years after the real health hazard had largely expired, where everybody had COVID once or twice and had some degree of natural immunity. But you're exactly right. We've got to rein in the administrative state. One of the things we've been focused on is WHO. You know, President Trump withdrew us from WHO, defunded WHO, and then Biden brought us back in. And you've got a movement by the Biden administration trying to put us under the control of the WHO, under the sovereignty of the WHO, the World Health Organization, which is an extension of the UN, which is essentially a mouthpiece or an ally of Chinese Communist Party, that in a whatever they declare a health emergency, which could be a climate emergency, a gun violence emergency, so-called gun violence, a viral emergency, the next virus or health, a poverty emergency, whatever, and then we would have to comply with whatever the WHO says to so-called mitigate what they decree to be an emergency. The Biden administration wants to surrender us to that without going through the set. First of all, we shouldn't do it, but if we're going to do it, even consider it. It ought to be ratified by the Senate as a treaty, and they don't want to even go through that because they know it couldn't get through the Senate.
Yeah, and that's so important to have those types of stopgaps and that kind of oversight so that it can't just be pushed through like what we saw during COVID, and it had to go through significant litigation on, you know, both the state level and then obviously all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And thankfully, they did not allow that OSHA mandate to continue. And otherwise, I really think that the Biden administration would still be telling us that we're in the midst of a COVID pandemic if they were able to continue to weaponize that. And the only reason that COVID suddenly went away is just because they were not able to foist that onto the American public through all of these mandates. And so that's why oversight is so important. And I'm speaking with Congressman Bob Good from the great state of Virginia. And let's also talk about the border. Polls and exit polls of primaries have shown recently that is the number one issue facing Americans as well as the economy. And the border is so important, and you have a really great clip up on your social media. I'd encourage everyone to follow. Congressman Bob Good is the chair of the Freedom Caucus. You can see all of these that you are speaking at a hearing, and the caption of this is, "The Democrats believe everyone in the world has the right to come to America. Since Biden took office, more than 500,000 illegal alien children have come to the U.S. and been used as pawns to benefit adults." These are just staggering numbers, and I don't think that the average person really stops to consider how much of an invasion this really is.
Yes, there's a number of aspects to it, and we obviously can't do it justice in time that we have. But on the one hand, there's the couple of million gotaways with terrorist ties, criminal backgrounds, trafficking drugs, children, sex trafficking in the country and all the rest, and the irreparable harm that will be done today by the evil, wicked, harmful people who are in the country and wish us harm. Only time will tell. Then there is the economic cost of, you know, 10 million who surrender to Border Patrol and the, you know, the hundreds of thousands that are coming every month, on or the strain on our social services, our education services, our housing, our health care and so forth, and when these that we can't sustain. But then there's also the changing of our country from a value standpoint, from a foundational principle standpoint. When you flood the country with people who didn't earn their citizenship, didn't pledge allegiance to our country, didn't embrace our Constitution and our founding and our culture and our way, but they're bringing with, you know, themselves what they from around the world, and they're not intending to change and become American. They're going to be hyphenated at best, or not even citizens, as you know, because they've come illegally. And when you ask the Democrats or the people on the left, how many is too many and how many from around the world should we let in here? Because they think there should be no limit, that everyone has the right around the world to come here legally or illegal, however they want to come, and that they get to decide and they get to choose and dictate to us, and that we don't get to be selective. We allow about a million legal, lawful immigrants a year. Who pledge allegiance, who earn their citizenship, who come to make us stronger and better. They're not going to be a drain on our society and a drain on our resources. They're going to contribute and sustain themselves. That's what America is. But this flood of the illegals, the lawbreakers, and the Biden's new executive order, hey, we're going to let 2,500 criminals come in every day first. And then after that 2,500, then we'll begin to figure out what we're going to do with the rest. Could you imagine? And I guess that's what's happening in the blue cities. We're going to allow so many murders a day, or so many rapes a day, so many, you know, violent crimes a day, and then we'll start to enforce the law after that. Could you imagine? That really is what's happening in our blue cities today.
It is just, it's so absurd. I mean, that is close to, if he allows 2,500 a day, I mean, just doing the math, that is well over 900,000 a year. I mean, this is not a cap whatsoever. I mean, this is just an executive order that is for optics purposes, I think, leading into 2024, because he's continued to say that he can't do anything about the border and then suddenly issues an executive order.
Yes, and he even retains parole powers beyond the 2,500, which means he can parole anyone else beyond that number into the country anyway. So it is a farce, just as you said. It is political cover. He knows he's deep underwater on the issue, and it's the first or second most important issue in every poll for every American, or the vast majority of Americans, and he knows it's going to kill him in the election. The Democrats know it, so they want to look like they're trying to do something about the border invasion that they caused and that they are facilitating even today.
Wow. And last question for you. We played the prayer from President FDR in the opening. That was 80 years ago today. How would you encourage all of us today to pray for the future of America?
Well, we need to pray, obviously, for our leaders and those in positions of decision making that direct our future in so many ways. Pray for our troops who are in harm's way. Pray for the families who support them. Pray for a return to our founding Judeo-Christian principles, our founding principles of the limitations of government, limitations of the federal government, staying within the boundaries of the Constitution, power to the people, power to the state and the local level, and that people who embrace that will be elected all across the country, and the evil that's within our political sphere will be defeated here in November. But between now and then, that those who are representing us now will have the courage to do right, have the wisdom to know what's right, and the courage to do it.
Amen to that. Representative Bob Good, always appreciate your time. We are out of time for Jenna Ellis in the morning. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. I'll see you tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.